I'm Kimberly Cronick, in for Jim Meadows, and today on Focus, we'll talk about getting financially fit. According to recent surveys, most Americans worry more about their financial fitness than their health, and they say they don't know as much as they would like about personal finance. Next week is Money Smart Week, and through a collaboration with the Federal Reserve Bank of Chicago and several locally operated banks and nonprofits across the state, there's a series of free events starting tomorrow to help you get to where you want to be when it comes to your financial fitness. On today's program, we're fortunate to have Karen Chan, the chairwoman of Illinois' Money Smart Week, as well as Kevin Waspy, lecturer of finance at the College of Business at the University of Illinois. Karen and Kevin look forward to answering your personal finance questions about planning for retirement, getting out of debt, budgeting, credit, and much more. Join me and join the conversation coming up on Focus. But first, this news. And good morning. This is Focus. I'm Kimberly Cronick. We're continuing to monitor the situation in Boston. You just heard the latest from NPR. You know that residents in that city and some suburbs have been told to stay home while authorities still search for the suspect. We'll keep you updated on the situation, and we will break into Focus with any further developments. We do have word that there's going to be an official press conference soon, so we will keep on top of that. We'll have a break about midway through the show and earlier if we need to. But we are talking about personal finance today on Focus with two guests. Joining me in the studio is Kevin Waspy, lecturer of finance at the College of Business at the University of Illinois. And joining me by phone is Karen Chan, financial educator, consultant, and chair of Illinois' Money Smart Week, which starts tomorrow, April 20th, and ends on the 27th. Money Smart Week is a public awareness campaign designed to help consumers manage their personal finances. Welcome to Focus, Karen and Kevin.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And we hope you'll call in with your personal finance questions. That's why we do this show. That number is 217-333-9455 or 800-222-9455. Or if you feel more comfortable emailing a question, you can do that as well. will-talk@illinois.edu. We also welcome your questions on WILL's Facebook page or our Focus Twitter. Our handles are at Focus580. Okay, well, Karen, let me start with you. Tell us about Money Smart Week. Who is it for and who's involved?
Money Smart Week is really for everyone, from youth to adults to older adults. It's an effort to help each of us learn what we need to know today to manage our finances more wisely. Most of us have some sort of a question or issue that we're facing, and during this week, you're very likely to find a workshop or an educational opportunity that will let you get information from a reliable source that you can use.
And this is a nationwide event, correct?
It is. It started a little over 10 years ago just in Chicago. The Federal Reserve Bank of Chicago is the force behind this, and it's their brainchild. But it caught on like wildfire and quickly spread to a lot of communities throughout Illinois, including there in Champaign County. And it's now in 45 states, and there are going to be a total of about 2,500 educational programs next week.
Wow, and they're all free, I understand.
They're all free, and they're presented by local organizations and individuals who are registered partners with Money Smart Week, and that includes everyone from banks and credit unions or other financial institutions to local nonprofits and groups like University of Illinois Cooperative Extension.
Great. And I went to the website, and that's moneysmartweek.org, and I clicked on the state of Illinois, and I found a variety of workshops. I found some on teens and money, kids and money, housing, mortgages, foreclosures, identity theft. I saw one on estate planning, credit and debt manage, money management for women. Also, this one was interesting, eating smart for your health and your wallet. So it sounds like whether you're just wanting to learn how to balance your budget or you have an estate that you need to plan for, it seems like the range is quite wide.
It really is. As you said, anything from I just want to get some tips on how to spend and manage the money I have better to I'm approaching retirement and I need some insight on how to manage the money that I've been able to set aside and how to maximize my income. to issues and questions about fraud. And I know there's been an issue there locally recently where people are concerned about identity theft, and some of the workshops will be dealing with those very current topics.
Great. So when we think about financial literacy and being financially literate, what really does that mean? What are we talking about?
I think it means that you understand basic financial concepts. And, for instance, when you read something, whether it be in a newspaper, in a magazine, or hear a show like this, that you're able to go, oh, I know what they're talking about. I could actually ask a knowledgeable question about that thing. To me, financial literacy means knowing enough that you can investigate and learn more.
Great. And I want to also tell our listeners, if you're a little shy or you're not sure you're that knowledgeable, it's also a good place to call in, because any question's a good question. And that number to call is 333-9455 or 800-222-9455, or you can email a question to us at will-talk@illinois.edu. Also find us on Facebook and Twitter at Focus580. Let me start with you, Karen, and then we'll go into Kevin, too. I just want to, since we're in Money Smart Week, give me a couple of tips on what's a smart way to use a credit card.
The smartest way to use a credit card is that you charge on it only as much as you know that you can pay off at the end of the month when you get the bill, and that you pay that bill in full by the due date. That means that if you've chosen a card with no annual fee, using that card will be costing you nothing, and you'll be building credit history at the same time.
Kevin, you want to add anything to that?
No, I think Karen's spot on. Credit cards are literally a line of credit that a bank grants to an individual, and it just so happens that you access that line of credit through the use of a piece of plastic. So the advice Karen's given is just spot on. We only access lines of credit for short periods of time, and we only access them when we absolutely need them. We hope to pay them off as quickly as possible because, generally speaking, the interest rate attached to a line of credit, whether you're an individual or a business, is usually a very high rate of interest relative to other accesses to money.
And that begs another question, Karen, is so I get a credit card, I pay it off. So, or let's say I have a medical emergency and I end up putting something on my credit card and I can't pay it off. Does a credit card, can they change the interest rate while I have it? Can they, so we get these long contracts. What's the smart advice for, even if you pay it off every month, we get into emergencies sometime. What's the smart advice about those contracts with that credit card company?
Well, the good news is that there were new rules passed a couple of years ago that the rate on your existing balance can no longer be changed. In the past, if an interest rate was changed on your credit card, it could affect an existing balance. That's not true today. But I want to point out actually a different issue about emergencies, medical issues being a great example. Before you put that medical bill on your credit card, you should talk to the medical provider and see what kinds of payment terms they provide. You may find that you can work out a repayment arrangement at a lower interest rate with your hospital or medical provider than what you would be paying on your credit card.
That's a great point. Thank you. Well, we love to take calls and questions, and we have one. Shelley from Urbana wants to know, she has a question about saving for her child's education. Shelley?
Yes. I have a young son. He's under a year, but obviously we know college is expensive, and we're thinking much, you know, far ahead. What do we need to do now or soon to at least start the process of saving for college?
Karen, you wanted to start with that one, and then Kevin?
Yes, I'd love to.
Thank you.
We have two excellent types of savings programs that you can use to save for college. One is generally referred to as a 529 plan. Every state has 529 plans, Illinois included, and the advantage of using this type of a savings vehicle as opposed to just a regular savings account or buying savings bonds or whatnot, through a 529 plan, you put money into the plan. Later on, when the value has increased and you use it to pay for college, there will be no income tax on the grossing the account when you use it to pay qualified education expenses. And especially starting with a young child like this, you know, 1 year old, this account's going to grow, you know, for 17, 18, 19 years before you deplete it. And so not paying tax on that growth is going to be important.
Great. Kevin, you have anything to add on that?
No, I think that's a good avenue, and I think it boils down to the basics. Whether the money goes into a 529 plan, into treasury bonds, or into a savings account, an investment account, whatever, the basics are as follows. The money that's saved won't be spent, and it will be available for future college expenses. I mean, it's literally, it starts with a budgeting process. Budget the payment to yourself. However frequently you get paid, make sure that a certain amount of money is going aside into a dedicated place for that purpose.
Okay, thank you.
And always the easiest way to save is put the money off the top when you first get your paycheck. Pay yourself first is the old adage, and this would be a great example of when to do that. Maybe have an automatic transfer set up, you know, from your checking account on the date your paycheck comes in over to the account that you've set up to save for college.
Karen's brought up a great mention there of paying yourself first. I'm a supreme believer in that, and that's why my payroll is automatic deposit, but I have it deposited to my savings account, and that sounds kind of backward because I need to pay bills, but it forces me to think of that money being mine in my savings first, and then when bills are paid, I need to physically transfer that money into my checking account to cover the check. So that's how I tease myself into thinking, pay yourself first.
Great. Okay. Thank you, Shelley, for your call. I want to remind you that you can call in as well and talk to either Kevin Waspy, lecturer of finance at the College of Business at the U of I, or Karen Chan, who's the chair of Illinois' Money Smart Week. The number here to call is 333-9455. You can also email us, will-talk@illinois.edu, or our Twitter handle is @Focus580. This is a great conversation, and I want to, she brings up children saving for college for her one-year-old. That's a great segue into what's a smart way to teach your kids about money? What have you found, Karen, as you've done these Money Smart Weeks? What are some people's needs? What do they need to know about that?
Well, I think the first thing is just that you make money a topic of conversation. You know, in some households, money is almost a taboo issue. Actually, in U.S. culture, it's often the case, you know, that we don't talk openly about a lot of financial topics. And I think parents probably just need to get comfortable with talking with their kids about, we're thinking about buying this, we're looking at how much it costs, here are some of the things we're thinking about. If you have a child, you know, that maybe you're giving up a few dollars a week, just talking with them about, you know, what do you think you may be doing with that money this week? How much does it cost, the thing you're interested in? Are you going to save some of that? Are you going to share some of that, you know, donating or, you know, putting toward a cause? And just starting a conversation so that you're helping a child think through the decision-making process rather than it just being, you know, knee-jerk, oh, they have money in their pocket, they see something they want, they spend it. Help them develop the habit of thinking and planning in advance about what they're going to do with the money they have.
Okay, we have another caller from Champaign on line one. Go ahead, please.
Hi, this is, I suppose, for Kevin. I just wondered, I want to double-check about my understanding. Currently, I have a Roth IRA at Fidelity, and I'm thinking of transferring it. I don't have the right language. Getting it into Vanguard instead because of the couch potato index funds that I can access at Vanguard. Now, I've had that Fidelity Roth for over 5 years, and my current understanding is that once it's moved into Vanguard, that I do not need to wait another 5 years to be able to access those funds. Is that your understanding?
Yes, that is correct. You've established the date of origin of a Roth IRA whenever you first set it up, wherever you first set it up. So the custodian or the trustee that acts presently is really a moot point. The fact that you did establish the fund, wherever you established it, is your origin date. I would only remind you that in wanting to move to a successor, trustee, or custodian, what you'd like to do is make sure that you do a direct asset transfer.
Right. I don't want it coming to myself.
Bingo.
That's exactly what Susie Orman says, too.
She takes after me.
So I could convert, say, and again, I don't have the right language, part of a traditional IRA, say dollar cost average, into that Roth, theoretically, that's in Vanguard.
Now we're talking about converting or moving money that's pre-tax in a regular IRA into a Roth?
Yes.
Okay, well, remember, that's a taxable event.
Yes, I know it is.
Okay, so I would sit down with a couple of pieces of scratch paper, maybe a sharp pencil or two, and someone that either has done this or has considered doing it before. I know both on Vanguard and Fidelity's website, they give you some basic tools and some things to consider when a person contemplates doing that. But think through the decision quite carefully before you decide to do so.
Thank you very much for your input.
You're welcome.
If I could chime in and just say that I like the fact that you already realize you don't have to convert the entire amount in 1 year. You can spread that out over years and spread that tax burden out and perhaps avoid pushing yourself into a higher tax bracket in any given year. So you're looking at this wisely.
Excellent.
Great. Thanks for the call. We're interested in your calls as well at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. Or you can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. Kevin and Karen are happy to take your calls. Karen Chan, financial educator, director, and chair of Illinois Money Smart Week, which starts tomorrow and goes through the 27th. And you can access all the events in the state of Illinois by going to moneysmartweek.org and click on the state of Illinois. And, of course, Kevin Waspy is lecturer of finance at the U of I's College of Business. Karen, another thing I noticed is some programs on money management for women. Are there special considerations that women have that are different from men that we need to pay attention to?
I think the bigger issue is that we still have households or communities where women may not have been as actively involved in the money management as the male in the household has been, or she may have been responsible for day-to-day spending decisions, but may not have been as actively involved in decisions about managing savings and investments and such as that. And so I think that's one of the reasons why we see programs targeted toward women is that in finances they are sometimes considered, if you will, an underserved audience, and we just want to try to reach out to all audiences, and that's one of the reasons why you see programs targeted to women. But women do have a couple of specific issues that set them apart. Women live longer than men. Women are more likely to need professional long-term care services because they do often outlive their spouses and there's not someone there to look after them. Women historically earn less than men, and if they do end up single or widowed in retirement, they are often dealing with a lower income than many men are who might be single at that stage. And so I think it's a situation where a woman has to be particularly careful and therefore needs to be especially knowledgeable so that she can manage the more limited resources that she may find herself dealing with in older age.
So I hear also is just communication about finances and where things are located and how much one has in retirement or life insurance, just making sure the surviving spouse can find the documents.
Exactly.
Right.
You know, in most households, one person has more of the responsibility for those things. You know, my household is actually kind of the reverse. You know, I'm the one who is more hands-on in managing those things. And it's super important for the other spouse to at least know, if something happens to you, where do I find all of the information? How do I get into the accounts? How do I know how much we have? And it's actually good to sit down and do a little report with each other periodically. It's kind of a joke in our household that every once in a while, my husband will say to me, give me a report. You know, even though he's not hands-on with our finances, he wants to know what's there, know what progress we're making, and stay on top of it.
Great. Well, retirement's a big topic on many people's minds, and we have a call about that from Chuck in Mattoon. Go ahead, Chuck.
Yes, I kind of an anti-saving thought here. I'm retired, and I have savings, but I get almost nothing for them. And it's more of a fear factor. And then secondly, the investments, of course, I'm concerned they will go down. And I have even I bonds, which are safe, but then they exclude, you know, food and gas from their estimates. And I just wonder, what kind of balance do you recommend for a retired person as far as risk versus you know, safety and so forth. You get kind of the gist of my thinking.
Kevin, go ahead and start with your answer on that one, please.
Yeah, I have a very good feel for what you're trying to get to. And let me just begin with a couple of trite sayings. They're not trite if you think about them. There's an old adage with investments. It goes like this. Do you want to eat well or do you want to sleep well? And as simple as that puts it, it illustrates a trade-off between risk and return. Now, aside from the current environment where we live in a world of basically zero interest rates, which I assume will be a temporary phenomenon, the fact remains the risk-return trade-off means that if we expect to get a higher rate of return, we're going to have to accept more risk. Each person's risk tolerance really should be tailored into the equation. One example, the couch potato portfolio that you see on the Will Radio Focus 580 website is just a suggestion. It is more heavily weighted towards stocks than it is towards safer investments. For example, you will not see any of the component of it being in certificates of deposit that are government insured at your local bank. But that can only be or should be considered to be one element or one component. In the complete portfolio of any individual investor, it's that risk tolerance that really drives the decision of all of the allocation, all of the assets. And I've always advocated that despite even current low interest rates, despite the fact that I'm being paid a penalizing rate on keeping money in savings, I'm going to keep some money there, and it's not going to be changed by the rate itself.
Okay, well, I'll look at that couch potato portfolio. That may give me some insight into how I want to distribute my own. Thank you for your comments.
You're welcome.
Okay, just to remind you that you can call in at 333-9455 or email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. We're going to come up with some news in just a few minutes. I want to start a conversation, though, while Karen's still here, with Kevin about retirement and about the behavioral things that we do that actually account that actually are impediments. And I bring this up because I happened upon a video on the Boston College website. It's called Curious Behaviors That Can Ruin Your Retirement. And it talked about how our DNA gets in the way. And I've got some things I want to talk about. First of all, the idea is just how long does retirement last? How long should we plan? How many years should we think we're going to be retired? Karen, any thoughts on that, first of all?
Well, financial planners that I talk to, almost without exception, are planning for their clients to age 95, and if they have longevity in their genes, they're planning for beyond that. This is a situation where it's like you can't afford to plan for too short of a lifespan because we really don't want to be facing harsh financial decisions when we're in our dotage and not the best equipped, you know, to make changes and deal with those things. But it is a trade-off. You know, you may be trading off a higher level of living in your early retirement to make sure that that you would have resources to last as long as you do.
So, right, if you think if you're going to retire at maybe 70 and you're going to live to 95, you're really trying to plan for 25 years of retirement.
Right.
That's decades.
Yes.
Okay, we're going to go to a short break, and then we're going to have an update on the situation in Boston, and then we'll be right back to take more of your calls. We are still talking about Money Smart Week with two guests, Karen Waspy, finance lecturer at the university's College of Business, and Karen Chan, financial educator, consultant, and chair of Illinois' Money Smart Week, which starts tomorrow and goes through April 27th. We'd love to take your calls. They can answer questions about many things on personal finance. The number to call is 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. And, of course, you can also email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. We were talking about retirement before the break, and I mentioned that there are things that our DNA does that sort of like our brains aren't wired to think long term, and we talked about decades of retirement that we have to plan for that. Let me give you an example of what this video said. Again, it's from Boston College. It's called Curious Behaviors That Can Ruin Your Retirement. And if you want to go through this video, it's a 10-minute interactive video. Lindsay Moon, our producer, has posted it on the Focus page. So just go to will.illinois.edu/focus and you can find that. But Karen and Kevin, what it said is that when you ask people, are they good drivers, 94% say they're above average drivers. Well, to be above average, right, there needs to be 49% of people who think they aren't good drivers, right? So we're dealing with this perception versus reality. And that's one of the things this video says is we may think we're prepared, but in reality, we may not be. Karen, any comments on that perception versus reality in terms of planning for retirement?
There are all sorts of biases that our brains play on us, and this is why the whole field of behavioral economics and behavioral finance has just burgeoned in the last few years. One of the jokes that I sometimes say in my workshops, well, it's kind of a joke, is that the way to make us better investors is to remove our brains from the process, because we do have things like this that make us think we're better. There was one study that showed that if a man was successful in investing, he attributed it to his skill. If a female was successful in investing, she attributed it to luck. The truth is probably somewhere in between. But we all have these built-in, not things that we're even conscious of, but we have these built-in ways of looking at things that are often programming us to not make good financial decisions. It's true.
Kevin, any insights on that, the behavior and how we plan for retirement?
Absolutely. Money, believe it or not, tends to be an emotional decision for many people. And part of that is just basically supercharging the way our brain works when we think through either a logical or an emotional type of process. So I think the field of psychology, the blending of psychology with finance, behavioral finance as it's known, the truth of the matter is, I mean, our mind does work and does do certain things that influence our decisions. It's a part of, how should we say, learning survival skills. But sometimes those skills work against better decisions for the long term.
Well, here's one. So we were talking about, so we may live 20, 25, 30 years in retirement. So that means we're into our 80s or 90s. Here's something most of us don't want to think about is our own death or the fact that we may need some form of assistance. I have a statistic here that says 25% of us will spend a year in a nursing home during our retirement. How do you counsel people on having those discussions with themselves, with a spouse, and maybe with their children and in the context of planning for retirement?
Well, I think the rising popularity, I'll use that word just because I can't come up with a better one, but the rising use of long-term care insurance certainly speaks to that. It's a product that 20 years ago was basically never discussed or never thought of, or you really had to seek out a provider to find it. But again, the longevity, the fact that on average we're living so much longer, it just brings about a need to plan for that eventuality. Whether it's through the use of long-term care insurance or some other type of arrangements, I mean, it just makes sense to consider the high likelihood that that will occur.
Karen, does this come up in the Money Smart Week workshops that you've been involved with, this topic?
I don't know if it's coming specifically in any of the ones in Champaign this week, but certainly anytime you talk about retirement, anytime you talk about managing risks, long-term care is at the top of the heap. One of the things that we're that makes long-term care insurance a difficult decision is that because there is a fairly large likelihood of your using it, that results in larger premiums compared to a lot of us feel like certain kinds of insurance are, you know, pretty good deal. You know, homeowners insurance, if you look at the cost of the premium compared to the value of your home, may not look terribly expensive, but that's because the likelihood of loss for most of us is relatively small. So long-term care insurance feels expensive. It's also a type of insurance that if you purchase it, you really need to be making a commitment that you will hold that insurance policy for the rest of your life. And so I sometimes say to people that if you're looking at the premium today and saying, well, I could stretch and make that premium payment, you really need to be asking yourself, what happens if 3 or 4 or 5 years down the road the premium goes up by 30%? What if down the road it actually goes up 50% or more? Can you still manage that insurance premium? And it's a hard decision to ask yourself which of three groups you belong in. Are you in the group where your income and your assets are limited enough that you really aren't a candidate for long-term care insurance? What you're saying then is, I'll just have to spend down my assets and hope that Medicaid will still be in place, you know, to look after me when I need that care. Or are you in the group who has enough income that you could probably manage the premiums, has enough assets that it makes sense to buy insurance to protect the assets, because that's really what long-term care insurance is about. Or are you so well off that you can afford to self-insure? Even if you are well enough off that you think you can self-insure, you might still look at long-term care insurance as a way of converting that very unpredictable cost into a more predictable cost.
I think Karen's made an excellent point. It's the very, very basic nature of insurance itself that she's just gone through that's really fundamental to this decision, and that namely is, can I afford to or do I need to afford to insure some event from devastating me? So fact is, you know, I take my personal view on that is, I am not trying to protect assets for my heirs. I am trying to protect whatever happens to myself and my spouse to not become a burden to my heirs. So that's my personal approach to it. But again, it fits an income level. It fits, an asset base. I don't have such a huge amount of assets that I'm trying to preserve or pass them on to heirs. I'm really only trying to keep from being a burden on my heirs.
We do have a question that came in through email. Let me read that to you. It says, I can't find a local Champaign-Urbana advisor to just ask questions about retirement. I'm 61. Everyone wants me to let them be long-term advisors. I don't want this. I just want to pay someone an hourly rate to answer some questions. Any suggestions?
I have one. There is an organization, a network of financial planners who specifically offer hourly planning. And I can't tell you offhand how many or whether there are representatives of this group in Champaign, but I would expect there are, or if not, not too far away. The network is called the Garrett Planning Network, and Garrett is spelled G-A-R-R-E-T-T. So that's GarrettPlanningNetwork.com, and you'll be able to do, anonymously, you'll be able to do a search there and find whoever might be in your geographic region, learn some things about that individual, and then, just as they were trying to do before, you know, call that individual, find out a little bit about them, probably set up an initial meeting, but if it's through that network, you will know that hourly planning services will be available.
Great. Thanks for that tip, Karen. And just remind our listeners, we are talking with Karen Chan, financial educator, consultant, and chair of Illinois' Money Smart Week, which starts tomorrow and goes through the 27th. There are about 2,500 events happening nationwide, many in your area. You can go to moneysmartweek.com. the website, and well, let me get that for you. I have that website, moneysmartweek.org. Click on Illinois to find an event in your area. Also here with Kevin Waspy, lecturer of finance at the College of Business at the U of I. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, or email them will-talk@illinois.edu. I wanted, something came up earlier about homes and our homes, and we talked again about, you know, retiring and having decades to go after we retire of life. What about this question about our homes, hanging on to them or downsizing, adapting? I know we talked about financial decisions are emotional. You know, if your kids grew up in that house, or if maybe you grew up in the house, or you inherited it, or you've just lived there a long time, what does what do you think about that in terms of keeping your home? I understand here that 1 in 10 older Americans move, and those who do seem to say that was the best choice they could make. What kind of advice would you give for people about keeping their home or downsizing, or something in the middle?
Anybody well, I would. I would say that it depends on a person's desires and then how those desires fit their budget. I believe unless a person has a desire to move into a living community, and I'll just use that as a real broad descriptor of different types of living communities, unless a person has a desire to do so, staying in their own house as long as they are physically able to, as long as the size of the house and the upkeep for it makes sense for probably a limited ability to do anything themselves, strenuous at least, or do things that cost money to have them done by someone else, as long as it fits the budget. I know my father is 92 years old. He lives in his own house to this day, and he's so much better off there just because he's able to. But that's not the case with everyone.
Karen, any thoughts on that?
I guess the one thing I would suggest is before you make a move, to have carefully evaluated what the true costs of that new situation will be. Because I think sometimes people expect more savings than they actually realize by downsizing or moving to a different location. And if I may, I'd like to mention a website from University of Illinois Extension that actually has some tools for making those kinds of comparisons. And the website is longtermcareillinois.edu. I'm sorry, longtermcare.illinois.edu. The website is obviously mainly about long-term care, but it also addresses the decision to move into various sorts of housing situations for older adults. And you'll find some budget tools and cost evaluation tools in there that may help you if you're doing this for financial savings reasons, so that you evaluate and really know whether you're going to realize those savings or not.
That sounds like a great tool, and we'll link to those links that you've been talking about on the Focus website after the show. Since we're talking about homes, a question came in here about mortgages, and I'm going to just read it. It says, if one has the ability to pay off their mortgage, does it make sense for them to do so in order to eliminate their personal debt, or should one leverage that debt in investments in order to try to grow their personal wealth? Who would like to take that?
Let me begin by just saying, again, risk return. If you're going to take more risk and hope to arbitrage a higher earnings rate than the cost of debt, it's a risky proposition. It's not something that I would generally advise a person to do. However, I would remind many people that look around, that find themselves at middle age or mature late middle age, interest rate costs on a home mortgage have never been lower. I don't know how long they're going to stay this low. I don't advocate a person borrow money against their house to do things like either spend it or make what I would say are inordinately risky investment opportunities. However, the older you get, and the more you move toward retirement, the less likely you'll be able to access credit through the use of your house or any other asset. So if it's a flexibility that you're maintaining, there is a cost to maintaining the mortgage, obviously the interest expense, but it is a tax-deductible expense. And at the low interest rates we're at right now, it's a little price to pay, relatively speaking, for maintaining a lot of flexibility. Fact is, you can always pay off the mortgage anytime you wish. And the way mortgages are written in this country, there is no penalty for doing so.
And the one thing I would add, I'm assuming from this question that the individual has no other debt. But certainly, if they did have any other debt, be it auto loan, credit card, what have you, all other debts likely are carrying substantially higher rates than the mortgage is. And so paying off other debts would always be the priority, only paying the mortgage off once all other debts have been taken care of.
Okay, we've got another question here. Let me read this one. Should one withdraw from retirement accounts, simple IRAs, for example, to pay down personal debt, such as unsecured debt from credit cards, or is it smarter to continue to save while carrying debt? The person wonders if it's smart to have money saved and still have outstanding bills, especially when retirement plans haven't earned nearly what one would have hoped in recent years.
Let me go first, Karen, if that's okay.
Sure.
Budgeting. That's the answer to the following question. What are the three most important things of handling money? So, silly me. I would strongly recommend a person budget for savings and budget for bill paying with a priority on paying bills first. It's a tough thing to balance. But the bottom line is this. I do not like to see people take retirement savings out and pay off, especially unsecured debts. I'll think of the Armageddon first, and then I'll think of things working well. In an Armageddon, your retirement savings are really sheltered from a bankruptcy process, and unsecured debt, the money you owe on a credit card, is, expungible. The not-so-Armageddon approach gets me to say, well, the plans work as they should. The bottom line here, again, is the cost of carrying any kind of debt, whether it's a bill at a merchant's on an extended payment plan or a balance on a credit card or an auto loan or whatever else, those costs are probably going to be higher than what you're going to be able to earn. So as it goes to savings or even investment rates of return on retirement monies, you just can't look at the differential in rates and say, well, I'm going to do it this way. There's more to it than that. Think about what you're doing. And again, every month, make a budget decision and stick to it that makes sense for you in carrying, you know, to the least extent possible, any outstanding money owed.
Yep. I agree with everything that Kevin said, and I'd like to underscore the point that the underlying issue is spending more than income. And until that issue is resolved, liquidating an asset to pay off debt is just a temporary fix. And I would really hesitate to see someone take that, as Kevin pointed out, an asset that is actually has some creditor protections and using that to pay off debts. And also, depending on the age of this individual, if this person is not yet age 59 and a half and they're looking at taking money out of an IRA to pay off debt, in addition to owing tax on the money that comes out of the IRA, they would also be saddled with a 10% penalty. That's a very expensive way to get money to pay off debt. And if the person is, even if the person's already in retirement, I still have the concern about taking an asset that you had set up to look after your ongoing needs in retirement and using it to take care of an immediate problem rather than your longer-term needs. So I agree. Budgeting and managing the spending problem, that's the real issue. And liquidating any asset to do that is just a temporary fix, and you may find yourself back in the same problem again in just a matter of a couple of years if you don't deal with the real problem.
Okay, we've got about 5 minutes left. We still have time for your calls or your email questions at 333-9455 or will-talk@illinois.edu. We're here with Karen Chan, and Kevin Waspy. I mixed those up here. Here's a scenario. I would wonder what you guys would do with this. Let's say you're 65. You get a $100,000 inheritance. What would you do? Would you take a expensive trip to Paris? Would you draw out $4,000 a year to live better? Or would you put a lot in savings and not spend a dime? And when you give your answer, tell me why would you do what you're going to do? Karen, you want to start?
Well, by nature, I'm a saver. And so I'm thinking, oh, sure, it goes into an account. Now, yes, if I need income from that in retirement, if I'm having, the money I already had wasn't quite sufficient for me to live on, then definitely I'm going to be taking those annual, I'm going to be tapping it annually for a small amount. And we've all heard the 4% rule, and we won't really get into that here today, but $4,000 would be, a general approximation of what I might pull out of it each year. But I think a lot of people would like to use a bit of that for fun, and there's nothing wrong with that. I think the trick is to ask yourself how much is reasonable to use for something that might have been maybe a lifetime goal that I haven't achieved. The whole amount doesn't have to be used in the same way. You can split it into buckets and accomplish several goals.
I love that approach. And again, back to a point Karen made earlier, which I think is really borne out in the scenario that Kimberly just gave us. You have a conversation with your family, discussion of money in the context of family is something that we probably don't do enough. So here's a $100,000 windfall. Let's have a family meeting. Let's sit down and say, well, we could feasibly spend it all. We could do this, this, and this. We could feasibly save it all. We could put it here, here, or here. But the start would be the family conversation. And I think a nice balanced approach, as Karen's already laid out, is, reward yourself to a certain extent, but realize that a windfall obviously gives you an opportunity. The reward once is like the windfall. It's a strike of lightning. It's a very low probability to happen again, so on and so on and so forth. Whereas putting something aside for the future has the potential to have a known reward over a long period of time that's a lasting reward. So what would I do after a little family meeting? If we decided that 10%, $10,000 was going to be an instantaneous use, whatever purposes, I'd look at a single premium annuity for the $90,000, and I'd literally put a floor under a per month income for myself and survivors for the rest of our lives.
Okay, we're just about out of time. I'm going to give each of you just one quick final word here, and maybe Karen, we'll start with you. Again, Money Smart Week is starting tomorrow. It goes for a whole week. What would you say to someone who's never been to Money Smart Week? Give us the quick elevator pitch to get someone to go.
Money Smart Week events are free. There are no sales pitches, and it's a great chance to explore any topic that you want to learn more about.
Thank you, Karen. And Kevin?
I couldn't have said it any better, Karen. I appreciate your involvement. We're running Money Smart Week through Central Illinois. I've left some Money Smart Week calendars for Kimberly here at the station, and I would say, as you've just done, I'd encourage anybody to take advantage of these opportunities in the coming week and learn more and become more comfortable with money decisions.
Great. Well, we thank you both, Karen and Kevin. Again, we are starting Money Smart Week tomorrow, and we have been talking with Karen Chan, financial educator, consultant, and chair of Illinois' Money Smart Week. Starts tomorrow, goes through the 27th. All the events are on their website, moneysmartweek.org, and you can click on Illinois or whatever state you're listening to us at and find events in your area. And as always, we thank Kevin Waspy, who's here with us the third Friday of each month. He's a lecturer of finance at the College of Business and at the University of Illinois. Thank you both for joining me today on the program. We appreciate it.
Been
Thank
a pleasure.
You, Kimberly.
And I want to let you know that you can always comment about Focus. You can send us your thoughts and comments about the program, this one or any other one, through our website. We take comments now. That's will.illinois.edu/focus. Of course, you can email them to us at well at will-talk@illinois.edu. On Monday's show, Jim Meadows will interview former Saturday Night Live cast member Julia Sweeney. She's known for both her infamous character, Pat, and her solo performances. Since her days on Saturday Night Live, she's toured as a one-woman show exploring love, cancer, family, and faith. Her new book is called If It's Not One Thing, It's Your Mother. She confronts parenting and what it's like for her as a single woman to adopt a daughter. That's Julia Sweeney, Monday on Focus at 10 p.m.